Kelly, Dr. Claire Kelly, who has been foundational and inspirational in her work with mental health first aid in Australia, having basically been somebody who knows from the inside the devastation of these issues. Claire's a passionate advocate for mental health issues and a provider of support for young people. Today she's going to talk about conversations we should be having with teens about mental health. Please welcome Dr. Claire Kelly.
This was a talk that had been brewing in my mind for some time. In the last few years, we've launched at Mental Health First Aid, our teen mental health first aid program, and that is directly teaching teenagers of high school age how to assist when a friend is experiencing a mental health problem or developing a mental health crisis. But obviously, there's only so much reach we can get with a program like that, and I think what we actually need is for adults of all stripes, parents and teachers and school staff and scout leaders and bus drivers, to be able to have conversations with young people about mental health that can make a difference. So I'm drawing from a couple of different sources here. When we began the Teen Mental Health First Aid program, we started with the question, what is the minimum amount that we would want every young person to know in order to be able to help their friends? So it was never about how much knowledge can we stuff into young minds. It was always about what is the minimum amount so that we don't increase anxiety around this material, but we can provide enough information to really make a difference. But I'm drawing from other places as well, of course. I'm drawing from my experiences talking to young people myself. I'm drawing from the experience of and the ideas of adults who had mental health problems or experienced mental health crises during their adolescence. I actually got online to a range of different social media areas and asked the question, what now do you wish you'd known as a teenager about mental health? And the responses to that were just extraordinary. One of the things that really struck me about it was that while a lot of what I got back was about mental health, a lot of it was not. People talked about the experiences that they'd had and how they wished that they had understood the consequences for their mental health of some of their experiences and some of their decisions. They talked about having had sex education without relationship education and the impact that that has had on their sexual behaviour and their self-esteem. And they talked about bullying and not just being bullied, but the realisation that they had been bullies themselves. So people do have an understanding as they get older of the wide range of things that can really have an impact on mental health. And of course, there are always conversations about mental health in the media, and some of them that are happening right now are very, very dear to me. But before I start, let's actually just consider the assumption. Should we be having these conversations at all? Does it really matter? Can it wait? And the answer to that, of course, is pretty simple. The earlier we discuss things with kids, the earlier they understand them. We talk about health and injuries when somebody's hurt themselves or somebody's in hospital or sick. Right from the time children are very young, we explain that someone is unwell, that they're going to get better. We talk about sex. I mean, that first conversation probably goes something along the lines of when a mummy and a daddy love each other very much, and probably in response to a very tiresome conversation about how you're about to have a little brother or sister. We even talk about alcohol and other drugs, and we do so in a way that's developmentally appropriate, starting from a really young age. I cannot be the only person in the room who remembers the Happy Healthy Harold. We often, when it comes to talking about mental health and when it comes to talking about suicide, we use a lot of euphemisms. She is very tired. What's wrong with mum? She is very tired. This is the sort of thing that can leave kids with the idea that if you're really, really tired, bad things can happen and you can behave in a way with other people that might be difficult to understand. He isn't himself. Now, I will admit, I might have been raised on B-grade horror movies, and my mind might go to demonic possession just a little bit quicker than most people's, but I know when I was a kid, the first time I heard this sentence, he just isn't himself, I did have the idea that this friend of the family had been somehow colonised, and I had grave concerns about whether he'd ever be back. Much less funny, when a family friend died by suicide, I was told that she had died of sadness. and like many other people, could be left with the sense that if you are sad enough, you might go to sleep and you might not wake up. And he did something very silly in response to someone's suicide attempt. Wearing your Batman pajamas to school is silly. A suicide attempt is a tragedy. So we use a lot of euphemisms and we need to stop. We can see there the just watching Maggie Hamilton talk about girls just after lunch, I was sitting here thinking, yep, we've got a world that is that much more challenging. We have to be that much braver to meet it. So this question that I asked, what do you wish you'd known in high school? I got so many, I wish that I could give you the full list, but it was absolutely enormous in the end, and I have to do something interesting with it. A really common theme was people saying that they wish that they knew that they weren't alone. And there were really two ways that they were talking about this. There were a lot of people who wished that they had understood that they actually could reach out, whether it was to adults, whether it was to friends, but also this lingering feeling that many of us had in high school and experiencing difficulties with our mental health, that we were the only person who could possibly be failing to cope so spectacularly. And in retrospect, of course, that is simply not the case. The impact that my words could have, I thought that was really interesting. People talked about wishing that they had realised at the time the impact of really negative statements and bullying and cruelty. That a cry for help meant someone needed help. That seeking attention meant a person needed attention. I treated some people horribly in high school. I think that's a very difficult confession to make, but a really important one, especially as many of my friends now have teenage children of their own. A couple of other ones. I wish that I hadn't kept secrets. I think this is important. This is going to come up in this talk as well. And my fun friend who drank too much and did funny stuff was depressed, and we had no idea. So some of the externalising and acting out that can go along with depression and anxiety and other difficulties. So drawing from some of this and some of what I can't put up on the screen, and drawing, of course, from the guidelines that we developed to underpin that curriculum I mentioned, that is really the source of where I've developed up my list of conversations. And here's the first one. I think it's a really, really important one. Mental health problems are really common in young people. If you do have a mental health problem or a mental illness in high school, you are not alone. And if you don't have a mental health problem or a mental illness, one or more of your friends probably does. And I think this is really important because we want kids to think about the way that they talk about mental health and the way that that might be impacting on the mental health of their friends and, of course, on their likelihood of seeking help. So when we talk about mental illnesses, diagnosable mental illnesses, depression, anxiety disorder, eating disorders, psychotic disorders, more rare during the high school years, but they can be beginning to emerge late in high school, and, of course, substance use disorders. And again, substance use disorders are relatively rare in under 18s. However, substance misuse is certainly present, and those who go on to develop a substance use disorder after the age of 18, once they've got probably more money and a little bit more access, and it's a little bit easier to get into the pub, they are at much greater risk of developing a problem. But it's not just mental illnesses we're concerned about here. We're concerned about milder mental health problems, subsyndromal problems, and, of course, just general psychological distress. So let's talk about numbers. And numbers can be a little bit boring. So instead, we've got little people. This is a classroom with about 28 students in it. So it's, I guess it's a government school, and nobody is sick despite the time of the year. A couple of years ago, a really important study was conducted in Australia called the Young Minds Matter survey, which is a health and wellbeing survey of young people aged 4 to 11 and 12 to 17. And in various ways, it was a conservative study, and their estimates are conservative. For example, they chose to focus on the report of parents rather than the report of young people themselves. However, even with their conservative estimates, at least 4 in 28, in a class of 28, are going to have a mental illness, a diagnosable mental illness, in any one year. And because I like to be less conservative and more think about what the scope of what might need to be done, let's add to that a few more who are likely to have milder problems, mental health problems, and may experience a mental health crisis even without meeting criteria for a mental illness. So we're already talking about around 8 out of that 28. So the numbers are getting pretty scary high. Here's some more numbers. We've got 28 adults now. This is 28 adults in the community with a mental illness, with a diagnosable mental illness. If they had depression, a quarter of them had their first episode before the age of 18. And half of them had their first episode before the age of 25. If we talked about mental illnesses more broadly, any mental illness, we'd say that half of them had an episode of mental illness before the age of 18. Sometimes this is going to be something like an anxiety disorder in early childhood. It might be a specific phobia that has been largely ignored because they don't tend to cause quite as much disability. For example, if a child has a real phobia around thunderstorms, you're going to have some rough nights when there's a thunderstorm, but there's not a thunderstorm every day, and frankly, if there was, they probably wouldn't have a phobia around it. And often we ignore those phobias because we think they'll grow out of them. And yeah, actually, they often do, but what they don't grow out of is an anxiety response to something that makes them fearful. And so a child with a specific phobia can become an adolescent with social phobia, is more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder after experiencing something terrible. A few more numbers and some very, very sobering ones. Once again, from the Young Minds Matter survey, of the 12 to 17-year-olds, 7.5%, that's 3 in 40, had serious thoughts of suicide each year. And that word serious is a little bit worrying to me as well, because how many had thoughts which they weren't sure if they should report as serious? And 1 in 40, 2.5%, made a suicide attempt in the last 12 months. And for a lot of them, nobody ever knew that that suicide attempt even occurred. When we look at suicide more broadly, 15 to 24-year-olds, suicide is the leading cause of death. 34% of deaths are from suicide. That's the blue part of my super special donut there. The orange part of the super special donut is 14%, which is motor vehicle injuries. So that's quite a long way down. And then accidental poisoning in the little grey part. Every other cause of death is represented by the yellow. So suicide is overwhelmingly the most common contributor to mortality in this age group. And as in addition to that, suicide and self-inflicted injuries, largely suicide attempts, is the number one cause of disease burden in males in this age group, and the fourth in females. I think at this point we'd have to agree that for a lot of young people, adolescence is really tough. So let's ask the question, why are expectations so very high? And I'm very pleased to be able to say that I'm very much going to reflect what Maggie was talking about just a moment ago with a more general basis, not just girls, but boys as well. This is often why expectations are so high. Meet your average 16-year-olds at a party on the weekend. That's certainly what I remember my adolescence was like. What about you guys? This is Riverdale. Now, Riverdale's in a bit of trouble, a bit of hot water right now because their final episode of the season featured a highly romanticised and sensationalised suicide attempt which did not result in a visit to hospital. But let's consider the source. Hands up if you look like this at 16 or 17. And look, honestly, this isn't even that bad. And let's be really honest, it is certainly not new, Dylan from 90210. So, television shows us a vision of high school which is extremely glamorous, represented by people considerably older than the target audience, none of whom have pimples or cellulite, and just for a bit of grit, of course, they've got to throw in some problems. Have you ever noticed how awesome problems are on television? I mean, they are great problems. Even the worst of them are usually solved within the hour, including advertising or 40 minutes if you're on Netflix. And if they're not, they become cool personality quirks, or else they are dealt with a much wider, more serious character arc by the end of the season. There are so many lies that are told here. And I think one of the most damaging ones when it comes to young people trying to support each other with mental health problems is actually that if you love someone enough, if you love them right, if you're a good enough friend, you can make the mental illness go away. And actually, many young people need the support of adults and treatment for their mental illnesses. Just to finish up, I want you to know this phenomenon goes back probably further than you think. Henry Winkler, 29 when he was hanging out with high school students on Happy Days. Okay, so let's discuss the cone of silence. The cone of silence does not help anybody. It doesn't help the young people we're concerned about. It doesn't help their friends. And it certainly doesn't help us as adults who might be in a position to make a difference and to provide some support and get some help. But it's a really hard cone to actually dismantle. Many of you will recognise young Hannah. I'm very, very carefully not talking about 13 Reasons Why today because I do not believe that I could do that in 8 hours, let alone 40 minutes. I have a lot of very strong feelings. And if you are still dealing with fallout from 13 Reasons Why and you're looking for some resources, Mental Health First Aid has resources that can be downloaded, suitable for parents, teachers, anybody who is talking to young people about this show. A 6-second summary is that Hannah has died by suicide before the show begins, and the 13 episodes of 13 Reasons Why are 13 cassette tapes in which she places the responsibility for her suicide on 13 different people. Now, there is a lot to talk about in this show, and I'm not going to do it, but one thing that really struck me right from the very beginning was this cone of silence between adults and kids. There were virtually no interactions between adults and young people that were not either purely educational or somehow adversarial or involved an adult who you wouldn't necessarily want your kids spending a whole lot of time with. There was no talking. Terrible, terrible things happened to Hannah in the show, and no, none of the adults in her life knew about them until after she had died. It seems like an obvious solution. We've got to get kids to talk to adults about things. So what we're going to do is make an announcement at school on Monday. From now on, tell us what's going on in your lives. I think that that's going to be successful. Keeping serious secrets endangers young people in many, many ways, including the fact that when something dreadful has happened, they need adults in their life to be able to provide support. But kids keep secrets for a lot of reasons. They're afraid of getting into trouble. And if I can share with you one very briefly, one of the stories that I was told by somebody who was responding to my question, what do you wish you'd known? She talked about having been at a party when she was 15, there was alcohol, there were boys, and she got into a situation where a boy was trying to coerce her into doing something she didn't want to do. In the end, she ran away from the party before things could get any worse, but of course left very distressed. About a week later, she said to her mum, I really need to talk to you about something. And I was at a party and there were people drinking and this boy, mum said, what were you doing at a party with boys and drinking? And now, I'm not blaming mum for this in any way. Mum has immediately gone, where did I fail to prevent this from happening? Because I know I'm not going to be able to fix it. But you've got to be able to put a stopper in that in order to prevent yourself from getting across the idea that when a young person talks to us about these sorts of things, the response is that they're in trouble. Because they're not. That's actually behaviour we want to encourage. There is a fear of being a burden, particularly when there's been an ongoing mental illness and difficulties along the way and behaviours which perhaps have needed to be managed, and young people can feel like, this is just too hard, clearly nothing's ever going to get better, so I've got to stop asking for help. There's a fear that no one can help, of breaking taboos and so forth. So here's our challenge. It needs to be easy for kids to talk to adults. We need to watch those reactions. We need to be reliable and respond in the same way each time. We need to believe them. We need to take them seriously. And we really need to avoid the urge to jump right into action or problem solving with a huge asterisk, and that is unless there is a risk of harm. When we do have to respond immediately in order to maintain safety, obviously we need to do that. But talking to kids naturally is actually probably one of the only things that we can do that is really going to make a difference. We've got to use opportunities to discuss difficult topics and controversial topics when it is not relevant to the young person's life, when something comes up on television, when something comes up in a novel in English, when a young person prepares a pristine and beautifully argued paper on why cannabis should be legal. We should be able to have conversations about that that don't end in, but you're not allowed to smoke it. And actually just be prepared to have those conversations so that it's without getting upset, without getting angry, but stating our own positions so that we can show that we don't always have to agree to have conversations and that we are capable of doing that in a calm way. this is probably the most important thing I'm going to talk about today. We need to talk about suicide. We really need to talk about suicide. The suicide rate in Australia has been, for a long time, it was going down, and we were congratulating ourselves and feeling really pleased, and at this rate there'll be no suicides one day, and it is climbing. We can't always stop it, but we can learn to try, and every single person can learn to try. I said this earlier, but suicide is the leading cause of death in young people. In fact, it's the leading cause of death in people in Australia up to 44. 9 out of 10 people who die by suicide have a mental illness. And this is not a mental illness that was diagnosed before they died, but a probable diagnosis made by psychological autopsy later on. It might be a little bit different for young people because we know that young people are slightly more prone to impulsive suicides. But even an impulsive suicide doesn't happen in a vacuum. A well-adjusted young person who copes with strong emotions, knows how to talk when they're experiencing difficulties, and is generally well balanced in their own life, is not going to make an impulsive suicide, which is why we actually need, as important as it is to look for warning signs of suicide and offer first aid when that occurs, when those signs occur, we also need to be getting in early and saying, hey, you know, if you're having a lot of trouble coping with strong emotions, this would be something that would be really good to talk to somebody about. A couple of the really big myths that we're still battling in the suicide prevention space in Australia, one of them is that people who talk about suicide don't do it. It's wrong. The research tells us that almost everybody who dies by suicide has tried to communicate something about it at some point. And there's nothing quite so tough as being at a funeral after a suicide and hearing people say, there just weren't any signs. And then later on in the day, someone will say, but there was this one time I felt like they were trying to tell me something. And somebody else will say, yeah, you know, there was this one time I thought they were trying to tell me something too. When someone is trying to tell you something, ask them. Asking about suicide does not put the idea in a person's head. This is really important. If that worked, I would ask you right now, if you were thinking about pulling the largest note out of your wallet and passing it up the front. And finally, and I think that this is a particularly important conversation to be having in the wake of 13 Reasons Why, suicide is the end of a person's life. It's not revenge. It won't fix anything. There is no satisfaction to be had by dying. And unfortunately, we still hear young people say things like, I can't wait to see their faces at my funeral. So we need to be having conversations about the fact that it's far better, you know, it's not a reset button. A much better reset button is actually to make changes in your life and to seek help for a mental illness. Really briefly, some of the signs that a person might be suicidal are talking about or threatening suicide. Yes, absolutely, and many of you are based in schools. Young people who are exploring suicide as a theme in their artworks or in health assignments, when they're picking a novel to discuss for English and they choose one that's around suicide, those are times when it is worth having a conversation, finding out why. Seeking the means, obviously, no reason for living, no forward thinking, particularly for a young person who has traditionally really looked to their future. But finally, your gut feeling is actually a sign that a person might be having thoughts of suicide. When we're talking about the people who are nearest and dearest to us in our lives, the people who, what is a gut feeling actually is a synthesis of everything that we know about a person, all percolating into this little corner of the stomach that's saying, you've got to ask the question. I hate the term attention seeker. I really hate it. And I wish that I didn't. I wish that I could say something as simple as reframe attention-seeking behaviour. When a baby is crying, it is seeking attention. And we don't say, oh, it's just an attention seeker, you know? Although maybe sometimes it is. But let me draw you back to that quote from the very beginning of my talk. Seeking attention means a person needs attention, and a cry for help means a person needs help. Research suggests that as much as 100% of the population needs attention at times. And when people are distressed, they need attention. So I don't think that we can ever really change the way people think about the term attention seeker, but I'd love you, every time you hear those words, to reframe them in your own mind as attention needing, as connection seeking, and as care eliciting. Young people might not have the best language to ask for the help that they need, but when they're asking, We know, we can feel it. There are three key actions that can be taken when a person is concerned that someone is having thoughts of suicide, and this is them. If you think someone might be having thoughts of suicide, ask them directly and unambiguously, are you thinking about killing yourself or are you having thoughts of suicide? Don't ask, are you going to hurt yourself? That's very ambiguous. Don't ask if they're going to do something silly. It's not silly, it's very, very serious. And don't say you're not thinking about suicide, are you? Because that's communicating that you want them to say no. Ask really openly, directly, unambiguously. If they say yes, work with them to keep safe for now. And finally, for young people, the next action is to seek help from an adult. For any of us, it's to seek professional help. This is a band-aid. It's only the beginning. If somebody has been having thoughts of suicide, the chances are that they have a mental health problem which is in need of help. Thoughts of suicide are serious and they should never be kept a secret. If a friend is talking about suicide, you need to get an adult involved right away. We've got to remember that thoughts of suicide are a life-threatening emergency and we need to respond to them. It's not annoying. It's not a burden on others, even if it happens more than once. And it's not less important than someone who is sick or hurt. Now, here is the caveat. If we start having these conversations, we've got to actually walk our talk. We've given kids, as soon as we talk about these sorts of actions, we're giving kids a big red button. And they need to know if they press that red button and they say, I'm thinking about killing myself, that your response is not going to be, people who talk about it don't do it. It's not helpful. Now, of course, when it comes to keeping secrets, it's not just about suicide. Anytime somebody is at risk of harm, safety trumps privacy, and this is a conversation we need to be having with the young people in our lives. It includes self-injury, bullying, assault, abuse, eating disorders, and alcohol and other drug use problems. The next conversation is kind of a two-parter. So 5A, it's actually pretty awesome to ask for help. It's not weak, it's tough as boots to overcome the self-stigma that so many of us carry around that says you should be able to manage this by yourself. But 5B is that it's also hard to ask for help, really, really hard. And you guys know this, it's not just about young people. People of all ages, all walks of life, all genders, with both mental health problems and physical health problems, have a lot of trouble asking for help, no matter how bad the symptoms are. So that's why offering help is probably better. The symptoms themselves can prevent recognition. Good recognition of other people's mental health problems, good mental health literacy, does not necessarily translate to a person being able to recognise difficulties that they're experiencing themselves. Self-stigma is a huge barrier. Oh, I can talk to young people and say, if a friend of yours was depressed, what would you do? And they'll say, oh, I wouldn't, I'd spend time with them, I'd let them know that I cared about them, I'd help them with their homework. And when I say, and what about you? What if you were depressed? How would you want to be treated? And they say, I'd keep it to myself, I should be able to manage that by myself. So it's self-stigma more than stigma. And there can also be ideas about what happens when you seek help that are incorrect and can prevent people from seeking help for themselves. So instead, encouraging someone to getting your young people to say, hey, if things are really tough, we need to talk to somebody about getting you some help. School counsellors, teachers, parents, anyone, everyone. So what kind of professional help do they need after that? That's kind of up to us to know. We need to have some good mental health literacy about this. We want the kids themselves to take their friends to natural adults in their life, people who exist in their social environment. Parents are best. We all know that sometimes parents are simply not going to be the right person for in the situation. And in some cases, parents can even be part of the problem. However, there are still going to be natural adults in the young person's life and often in a school environment. Mental health professionals are fine, but without support at home and school, the effectiveness of what they can do is going to be somewhat limited. So creating supportive links helps to keep everybody safe. Now, of course, as adults, we do have an obligation to make sure that if a young person brings a friend and says, hey, there's some stuff going on here, we think we need to get some help, we actually need to take the next steps. Another really important conversation to have. Your peers are not actually using a lot of alcohol or other drugs. And that's radical. You're about to see some statistics you may not have seen before. Oh, and of course, those who do might have mental health problems. So in the 2013 National Drug Strategy Household Survey, in the last 12 months, 85% of 14 to 19-year-olds had not used cannabis. You've probably seen that 15% have, no problem at all, but 85% have not. different way of thinking about it. 96% had not misused pharmaceuticals. 97% had not used ecstasy. 98% had not used amphetamines or methamphetamine. 99% had not used cocaine. And a really important one, 69% had never consumed a full standard drink, and most didn't drink to get drunk. Of course, that does not mean that it's okay. Substance use amongst young people is a very serious problem, and it increases the risk of developing a range of other problems. And particularly for young people, it increases the likelihood of risky behaviour, which can cause injury in the short term as well. 50% of people who will ever go on to develop a substance use problem began misusing when they were under 18, and in fact, the biggest risk is under 15. Young people with mental health problems can often start actually using substances as a way to cope, and then that becomes the main way to cope, which is obviously not ideal. And young people often perceive their peers' use as being much higher than it actually is. Peer pressure, the traditional after-school special approach has been just have one drink, everyone else is doing it. But actually, what is more likely to be described by young people is the feeling that they believe that somewhere where there is a lot more fun happening, everybody else is doing it, and therefore they should. So we need to be talking about something incredibly important here. It is time to normalise the decision not to use. There is a lot of other fun stuff to do in the world. Okay, there are things that young people can do to reduce their own risk, and this is really important too. Self-care is not a waste of time, and it doesn't have to be a big deal either. It doesn't have to be a huge amount of work. It's not about spending a month in an ashram in India. There are simple self-care strategies that everyone can use, and frankly, all of us could be using as well. Nothing can eliminate the risk of mental health problems, but good social relationships are really important. That's a really good start. Getting plenty of sleep helps memory, concentration, and both mental and physical health. Something I find young people just love, just a little bit of neuroscience. It doesn't have to be in depth, but just little stories. And one of the things I think is really useful to share is that the hippocampus, in a sense, is both librarian and library. I like thinking of it as kind of a snail that just kind of picks up bits of information and decides whether to stick it in the shelf or toss it aside. But most of the work that the hippocampus actually does happens while we're asleep. And if young people are not getting enough sleep, they're not learning enough, they're not remembering enough. A young person who's up at 3 o'clock in the morning is not actually, even if they're studying hard, they're not actually probably learning anymore. That sleep is one of those most fundamental things. Of course, good luck explaining to teenagers that they probably need more sleep than their little brothers and sisters. Getting a good amount of exercise. Now, this is tricky waters because we have also got a rise in eating disorders. And we know that a young person who starts using over-exercise as a way of coping and as a way of trying to control the shape and weight of their body, that can become obsessive. But regular, moderate exercise is immensely valuable. It's important that young people do things that they enjoy, particularly things that aren't about competition but accomplishment, and actually learning a new task, memorising a new piece of music, whatever it might be, things that are enjoyable and leave that sense of achievement. And finally, when things go wrong, talk to people that you trust. And of course, it's our job to be people who they not only trust, but feel able, to approach. So the basics, talking about mental health from a young age, talking to young people about mental health from a young age will normalise it, make it easy for them to talk about it later on. Talking directly about suicide and the importance of asking about suicidal thoughts when we suspect that someone might be experiencing them will help young people to assist when they're concerned about a friend. We can all contribute to bringing down that cone of silence. We can. We just need to do that in a way that builds slowly and uses opportunities to have conversations that we might not actually be that comfortable having. And encouraging young people to help each other can ensure that help is found sooner rather than later. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd like to point out, if anyone who is not aware of the Mental Health First Aid program, the website has a wealth of information, including lots of downloads that you can distribute and use in various different ways. You can also find out information about attending a course or seeking an instructor. Thank you very much.